Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. I will be your chair for today's program, New Visions in Architecture, the San Francisco Public Utilities Headquarters Building, a LEED Platinum building. Our speaker tonight is Ed Harrington, and he's also introducing people who have worked on the building with him, and so that you'll get to know them also. Ed recently retired as general manager of FPUC. He's highly respected for all of his work in San Francisco. I met him many years ago when we had a group called the Bay Area Water Stewards, and we were involved in what was the beginning of the planning and getting things done to do all the retrofitting and correcting and enhancing of our water system, all the way from the reservoir, the Hetch Hetchy, following the Tuolumne River, down into the Bay Area. And one of the things that I learned about Ed was what a terrific mediator and coordinator he had. He not only had to deal with all kinds of rivers and creeks and reservoirs and wetlands and you name it, in terms of the water system, but he also had to deal with all of the rest of us, people who were in the communities or who were concerned about certain issues. That group, we all ranged everywhere from the Sierras down through the Bay Area and up to San Francisco. So if you don't think he had a very complicated and difficult job, you have to think again, because he had all of us, and he had all of the work that had to be done, and he had all the different situations. But actually, when we came to the end, we all felt a great deal of respect, how he brought us together, talked to us, listened to us, and finally, we are seeing this project make tremendous progress. And we're very proud of all of that. And without Ed, I don't think we would be here saying that. I wouldn't be here saying that tonight. Now, at the same time, Ed had his sights on 525 Golden Gate Avenue. And at first, I didn't know what he was talking about, but now I do. And I do hope you go see the building. I'm really fond of buildings, and I've seen all kinds of green buildings, from silver to gold to platinum. And for me personally, this is my very favorite large business platinum building because of the aesthetics and the care and the thought that went into this building and what's in the building itself. Equal to that, though, I have to say there is a smaller building down in Santa Monica that is one of the original platinum buildings, and it is also a wonderful aesthetic example. So we do have examples of the kind of work, but nothing like we will see now when you look at the slides and the information that Ed has and what they've been able to do with 525 Golden Gate. I was going to say Market, but we're 595 Market. That wouldn't work. So tonight we will begin, and we will welcome Ed, and we'll go forward with the program, and I welcome you again. Bye-bye.
Good evening, and thank you very much, Ann. Yes, I am Ed Harrington. I'm the retired general manager of the SF Public Utilities Commission, but you'll notice tonight I'll probably keep saying the word we because I was there so long and in the city so long. It's still we. And I am joined by Brooke Mabatu. When I was thinking about coming in tonight, my view of the building is very much from an owner-user point of view, and I realize there might be a number of you who might want to know how it actually works. And so having the project manager from the Department of Public Works who actually built the building, I thought would be a nice addition to this team. So that's why both of us are here tonight. And I'm going to go through it from a user perspective and some general things, and I'm going to ask Brooke to really talk about the seismic strengthening of the building, the concrete in the building, and also what we call the living machine. So you'll get a mix of a kind of a user perspective and a builder perspective. What we thought we would do, I'm assuming most of you know what the Public Utilities Commission is from San Francisco, but I will do a quick review of that and then go into, again, the building and how it's put together, but then also from a user perspective working in the building. We are a department of the City of San Francisco. We provide retail drinking water and wastewater services to San Francisco, also wholesale water to three Bay Area counties. We have hydroelectric and solar power facilities throughout California that we use for San Francisco government. We have about 2,500 employees, and we're going to be spending about $10 billion in capital over the next 10 years. It's a very infrastructure-rich organization. The Water Department is responsible for the collection and distribution of water and treatment of that water. We have 2.5 million customers. We provide about 265 million gallons a day. It makes us the third largest water system in California. 11 reservoirs, 2 water treatment plants, and many, many miles of tunnels and pipes and things. This is a picture of the system, and so you'll notice that it does start in Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite National Park. It comes up. We have major reservoirs up there, and then we have reservoirs in the East Bay and on the peninsula in San Francisco. Many of you see those as you drive on Highway 280. You'll see Crystal Springs and some of those, but those are actually relatively small reservoirs. Most of our water comes from Hetch Hetchy, and most of our water is stored in snow most years. We'll have to see if that works this year or not. And you'll notice the color that's in this map shows our service area. So it's San Francisco, virtually all of San Mateo County. It also duplicates the map of Silicon Valley. So you'll see virtually all of Santa Clara County going into San Jose and then up into Hayward. One of the reasons that we believe Silicon Valley is there is that the water quality was so good, it made it easier and cheaper to manufacture silicone chips. We have a combined stormwater and sewage system in San Francisco. This shows you a picture that we have both your sewage from inside your homes and stormwater from on the street. It goes together. When there are major storms, it does overflow into the bay and the ocean, and we're trying to do as little of that as possible. Most of it is captured. And if you ever go onto the Embarcadero or if you go to the Great Highway, you are standing on top of major sewer boxes. Those boxes are about 40 feet wide and 30 feet deep. The idea there was that when there's a lot of water coming in from rain, we store it so that it doesn't go into the bay or the ocean, and then we process it as we have a chance. You didn't want to go out and build huge new treatment plants in San Francisco, so we built big storage facilities in San Francisco instead. But this is a picture of our Oceanside plant, which is out off the Great Highway in San Francisco. And the power enterprise, too much going on in this slide, but you can see that we have major hydropower facilities up outside of Yosemite National Park using water from Hetch Hetchy and also the other lakes that are up there. We also have one of the largest solar facilities by any government agency in California with the 5-megawatt Sunset Solar on top of one of our reservoirs. And you'll notice a variety of other solar kinds of things on city buildings in San Francisco, some biogas at our wastewater treatment plants. And this power is primarily used for city government. So it powers the airport, muni, the hospitals, fire stations, all those kind of things. We provide enough clean, green, renewable power to do all of that. And again, that was just a quick reminder of what we are. But when you're talking about building a building, if you want to build a green building, you can just do it because you're a good person and you want to do right. This is actually what we do for a living, though. You know, we're an organization that is infrastructure rich, that in fact is talking about all the time things like water conservation, sewage treatment, how those things work, how you generate green renewable power. And so for us to build a building and not take that into consideration would have been shameful. And so it was really a no-brainer in many ways to go ahead and build this building to showcase the kinds of things that we do and that we expect others to do. So the building was designed to conserve water, to conserve energy, and also provide some energy. We really wanted to make this a blueprint and a model for other people. We wanted to reduce harmful greenhouse gases, and we wanted to really make this an essential part of the building, not just an afterthought. So we've actually gotten awards for having this be one of the smartest buildings in the world. And sometimes I wonder if it's one of those, in the old days you said, I can run a Volkswagen, but if you give me a Cadillac, too many things can go wrong. This is a building that is so smart, we are still working on trying to make parts of it work well, because there's all these different components that are supposed to integrate and work, which is great when it does, and it's interesting to keep making sure that it actually does and makes it work. The idea was to be energy efficient, LEED Platinum, as Anne said, but also a healthy and effective office for our staff. And cost-effective. We do get our money from ratepayers. We weren't just going to go out and spend money without having some idea of this being a cost-effective building, a sophisticated design, because it is an iconic building in San Francisco and a global model. It's a 13-story Class A office building, about 280,000 square feet, and we have almost 1,000 employees working in the building. We had a commitment to really making sure that this building also was assisting San Franciscans who were out of work, especially in the recession that was going on when we were building the building. And so over 40% of the construction jobs were performed by people that live in San Francisco. Most buildings have parking spaces. Again, as part of our commitment, we only have two parking spaces inside the building, and we have one outside. All three of those are electric-powered. But we do have places for 65 bikes. So you're welcome to ride your bike over there or take transit. We also have a childcare facility for up to 65 children in the building. Water efficiency was one of the first things. And so an average building in San Francisco, the average worker in that building uses about 12 gallons of water a day. This building, they use about 5 gallons of water a day. So it's a 60% reduction in the use of water. And much of that is because of what we call the living machine. The living machine actually recycles all of the gray and black water in that building and reuses it for use in the building. At some point, our hope is that when people get more comfortable with reusing water like that, it spins off enough water to actually provide water to water a civic center also. But right now it's only being used in the building. And Brooke is going to go through how that actually works and how the tidal wetlands idea really works. But it is reused in the building for toilets and urinals. We also harvest and treat rainwater, and we have a major rainwater tank in the basement of the building that also captures all the rainwater from the roof and reuses that in the building. High-performance building envelope reducing lighting densities. The way that you really use energy has so much to do with heating and cooling a building and lighting a building. So that was a major part of this whole discussion of the building. And so when you see some pictures coming up, on the south side of the building, you'll see all these different louvers that are there that look like it's a very busy-looking building if you're looking at it from the Civic Center. Part of that was twofold. One was to have shade so you didn't have heat coming into the building, and the other was to provide light. So light bounces off of those shade-producing things and brings light into the building and daylights the harvest. All the lights in the building are smart lights. And so if your light is closer to the wall and it's the wall of windows and the sun is there, the light turns off. As you move into the building, the lights get brighter. Every light bank moves and gets brighter and darker depending on what's going on, depending on how light or dark it is outside. There are sun sensors on the building that see where the sun is going and open and close shades on, especially the south side of the building, to try to make sure that you have the shades working so that if it's too warm, you bring the shades down, and when it's not, you raise the shades up or you move them back and forth. There are also shades inside the building. So these are outside on the top of the building. There's also shades inside that allow you either mechanically or by hand to move those shades up and down. And there's windows that open, which is really kind of cool still in San Francisco to have a building that you can still have that kind of a thing. All of the air circulation is under the floor. So many people, you walk into some office buildings, some people have these shades or umbrellas over their heads because they're freezing or they're too hot. All of this comes up from under the floor. And to make sure that our folks were comfortable, every individual has their own floor circulation thing where they can turn on or off any kind of air coming out so they can manage their own circulation around their own cubicle. Again, renewable energy, you'll notice here you're seeing a little bit of the turbines, the wind turbines that are in the front. The building is designed to scoop this way and to scoop up, and it was really designed, if you've ever been on that corner in front of the federal building, you can get blown away. It's not quite as bad as Market Street when Polk gets into Market. But this was designed to capture that wind and actually use it. Wind turbines are a new thing still. They're not really all that efficient, but that's a 100-year building. By the time that building is into its second or third, decade, hopefully they'll have wind turbines that actually do generate a lot more power. These look nice, and they generate some power, but not a whole lot yet. And again, the entire system is integrated so that you're supposed to be having your shades go up and down, your air conditioning come on and off, and everything working together. And so far, it mostly works. You'll notice on the left side of this picture, the two of the different places where we have solar panels, so we have them on two floors, and then the entire roof of the building is solar. We originally were going to put windmills on top of the building, but we really, even though the wind is so strong there, it's not that strong on the top of a 13-story building, and it wasn't going to be an efficient wind system for most of the year. Solar provided more power than a wind system up there. And you'll also notice that in the lower right-hand corner, most of the floors, the offices are in the interior, and most of the staff are in lower cubicles, because that's the best way to harvest the daylight and bring it into the building and not have to use a lot of light and a lot of heat, actually. If you have offices, especially on the south side, you're heating and cooling them a whole lot more than you are if you let it more for air circulation there. So 32% energy savings compared to a regular building. Over the 75 years, we say it's a 75 to 100-year office building, we'll have $118 million in energy savings just from being able to do the daylighting and the heating and cooling differently. Even with the windmills in the front, the turbines in the front, and all that solar on top, it only provides about 7% renewable power for the building. So that's unfortunate. You would like to provide more than that, but it was what's available in a fairly small footprint of a building. The good news is that all of the other energy comes from HETI. So all the energy that's used is all renewable, but 7% is actually generated on site. And 45% reduction in terms of the power that it takes to illuminate a building because of all that daylight harvesting. The recycled materials in the building, and Brooke will talk about this a bit more, so I will go quickly, but we really wanted to make sure that we used recycled materials and didn't have to do a large carbon footprint as we built this building. So you'll see that 70% cement replacement, and he'll tell you what that means, along with the carbon footprint of that building as we built it. We really did want to make it a different kind of building. And what you'll see in here, I'll come back to in a few minutes, but what you'll see on the right side, for those of you who haven't been in the building, that's the art media wall in the lobby. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. It's a stunning kind of fun thing. Daylight harvesting, increased natural views, natural things. Communicating stairwell, you know, most of the time you have to have two stairwells in a building that are fire safe for access for the people in the building, but also for the firefighters coming in. That takes up so much room in your building, you often don't get another stairwell that people can just use that's friendly. And so people always end up putting little pieces of cardboard holding open the fire escape doors, and they go down these rickety stairs kind of in the background and can't see anything. We really wanted it to be different, and so we have our second official fire safe stairwell is a beautiful stairwell that encourages people to walk up and down the flights, and you'll see some other pictures of that in a few minutes. So, yes, it's a LEED building. Silver LEED is 50 to 60 points. Gold is up to 79 points, and platinum starts at 80. So we are at 84 points for a platinum building, and that's why we're saying it is a LEED platinum building. You can see there are some things we do really, really well. In San Francisco, it's pretty easy to get the transit points for LEED because you have Muni there. But water efficiency is great. Energy and atmosphere, you could spend your entire life working on energy and atmosphere kind of things. We've done a whole lot, but obviously not everything you possibly could do. And the materials and resources, for those of you who might have remembered the old state workers' comp building that was at that site, it was an asbestos-ridden building, and when we knocked that down, we really did have to remove most of the building structure and most of what was there. And so we've lost points because we didn't reuse the actual concrete or steel that was in that building at the time. The construction cost was about $150 million for a total project cost of about $200 million. We say our savings over 100-year life is $3.7 billion. That's a little misleading. We were renting our space. So we are an organization that expects to be around a long time. We run the water system and power system and wastewater systems, and we were renting our headquarters in San Francisco for all these years. It was time to build our own building, so a major portion of that savings is really that once this building is paid off in 25 years, it's free for the next 75 years. So there's a portion of it that is energy savings and water saving, but the really big thing there is that it is going to be rent-free for most of its life, and so the PUC will finally have a home that it can call its own and be proud of. But even so, the present value savings is $500 million. So, again, we wanted to be true to our ratepayers and say, if you have trusted us with your money, we're going to build a building you can be proud of, but you also are building a building that's not gold-plated, that's not just wasting your money, it's money that will, it was a building that will save you money over time. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brooke to talk about how the building actually works and also the living machine.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we are now going on to our second speaker, and he will begin right now.
Good evening. So, thanks, Ed. I'm going to touch on, going to back up a little bit, give you a little bit of history before this slide here. This slide talks about, you see the note above, it says, original design called for a resilient steel structure. Problem, too costly. So in 2008, when I came on board and Ed came on board with the Public Utilities Commission, one thing Ed didn't mention was he was a city controller for 17 years before he took over the water department. And so I had a client who was very astute when it comes to finances and how to get things done within budget. So in 2008, when we first estimated the cost of the work at schematic design level and design development level, we were a little bit over budget. So one of the things we looked at to cut costs or opportunities thereof was at structure. Where are the cost savings available in structure? And so steel structure was very expensive to build, and we said, well, can we do a concrete building? Of course you can do a concrete building, but in order to meet the same type of seismic performance required for this 100-year building that Ed referred to, it needed to be, it was going to be 3 feet by 4 feet columns, fairly huge structural systems. But we were able to find this very collaborative and innovative structural engineers out of the East Bay, and they said, well, we can keep it same size as you have it designed under steel structure. However, what we want to do is bring in old technology, which is bridge technology, into a building. And that is a vertical post-tension system into a building. So typically you see when concrete structures are going up, you will see what we call post-tension tendons coming out of the edge of the slab. As they're pouring concrete, they pull the tendons, they stress it, and they move forward. This time, we did it vertically. So in the image that you see on the right with the cutaway, those the red things that come down and loop at the bottom and go back up, that's essentially the two core areas. Those are the pillars of a project. So in the core area, typically is one staircase, and another core area is the elevator banks, what we refer to as elevator banks. And so those tend to have a real congested rebar, what we call mild steel, with concrete. In this case, by going to concrete structure, we were able to reduce rebar, and I'll get to those images showing that. But we had set a goal. So we got together both with our clients, with the design team, with the contractor. We wanted to implement this state-of-the-art, innovative way to bring in bridge technology into a building. And the reason was to achieve that resiliency. One of the sustainable things to do for a 100-year building is to build a building that would last 100 years. So in order to do that, we set a couple of goals, and that was to create a performance-based specification for a high-performance concrete building. The other one was to build the most sustainable green concrete possible. But we also wanted to have no impact on schedule, no impact on constructability, and the same cost as a conventional concrete building. And obviously it must be suitable for a public bid. And what we mean by that is it can't just be such a proprietary specification that only one concrete supplier can build a building. So this is the image you see on the left is a steel building. At the time, it was a 12-story, not a 13-story, what we have now. And the image on the right is the concrete building, which is actually 13 stories. And the one on the left has 155 viscous dampers. Those are dampers that kind of slow down the seismic forces on a building. Well, we were able to get rid of that and actually build a 13-story building, which helped us realize more value. And so one of the, and I'll talk about some of the advantages of going to a concrete building, is it helped us trim construction. Some may say, well, wait, steel actually goes up faster than concrete. In this case, the way we came up with a structural solution from formwork to pouring concrete to peeling off the formwork, we were able actually to trim the schedule, which resulted in $10 million in savings. The $10 million in savings was not only in addition to doing the concrete, but it was also when you do a concrete building versus a steel, you don't have to put additional materials up, drywall or different types of materials on the buildings, which is more green. The less materials you use, the better for the project. And then what we refer to here as a high-performance building. In order to build a 100-year building and also allow PUC to be operational at all costs, even after a seismic event, we built it to what we call a 1% drift. That is the floor acceleration across each floor from a seismic event. That's the seismic energy going through the floors. So the code requires that you do a 2% drift. This building actually has a 1% drift. And there wasn't anything extra that we did to get there. It's the type of system that we utilized that allowed us to achieve a highly resilient building, what we essentially refer to as a immediate occupancy. So in the event of a seismic activity, PUC has to continue to operate. They have to track all the reservoirs or the power stations, and it needs to be able to be occupied. So we wanted to approve minimum damage to the building in the event of a major seismic earthquake. As we know, there's a 70% probability of a magnitude of 6.7 or plus earthquake in the next 30 years here in San Francisco. So in addition to the schedule, I talked about how the steel building was a 12-story building. The concrete is 13 stories. By going to a concrete building, we were able to reduce what we refer to as floor-to-floor height. It was 13 feet 4 inches. We reduced it 12 feet 4 inches. So by taking out 12 inches on each floor, we essentially took out 12 feet from the building. But we also wanted to maintain the same height and scale to the surrounding civic center area buildings. But while we realized cost savings, we left it at the height of what it was as a steel building and added another floor. So we were able to add value to the building by adding extra square footage. And this is technical, but we're able to achieve, this is a high-strength concrete. There's regular strength and high-strength concrete building. This is a high-strength concrete building. As Ed referred to earlier, it allows increased natural daylighting. And the reason is when you do a steel building, typically you would have what we call an upturn and downturn beam. Those are beams that hang down below from below the top of the slab and from above the slab that you're standing on. So that reduces the opening from floor to floor that allows natural daylight to come in. But the way the building was constructed, we didn't have to have any upturn and downturn beams. So that increased daylighting provided additional natural daylight, which is harvested and requires less illumination to illuminate the space due to that. In addition, what we refer to as concrete reflectivity. One of the bad things for the environment is cement. Cement has a huge carbon footprint. It's to manufacture it. It's very bad for the environment, but you can use other byproducts that are also bad for the environment as a replacement for concrete. So a byproduct of coal, which is called fly ash, and a byproduct of steel factories, which is slag, reacts the same way as cement when it goes through a chemical reaction when you're pouring concrete. So we push the envelope of the usage of those two in this building. We have up to 70% replacement in what we call the mat slab, the slab below the basement. All the core construction and the columns have 70% less cement. And then all the floor decks have up to 56%. And what that did is it reduced the carbon footprint by 7.4 million pounds. So the structure of this project reduced its carbon footprint by 50%. That's a huge number. And lastly, by going to concrete, we can use concrete as thermal energy to harness the energy, the heat, and then release it at night and vice versa. I referred to the core construction earlier. So the two images that you see, one on the left is a typical core construction where you see the openings, the white portions are openings into that core area. But in order to have that opening in the core walls, you have to have those X braces that you see. That's what we call a typical conventional link beam. So because of that opening, that's where the weakness is. But if you look at the one on the right, that's the PUC building. That has 50% less rebar than a typical core construction. What that meant was we can build a core wall much faster because the image you see in the middle there with what we call a post-tensioned link beam is that can all be manufactured in a shop. And they can bring it on site, put what we call the bucket. It's a U-shaped steel. Rebars are already welded in there. So you bring it on site, you bring it to the opening, you charge the rebars through them, and you have just as strong, if not stronger, link beams that can be fabricated off-site, and you have increased construction opportunities. The image on the left is what Ed referred to as that what communicating stairs. That's an amenity that we were able to offer to the employees at the PUC. And the, Ed mentioned it earlier. We had two egress stairs required by code, and then we had another third stair. And Ed said, no, that's too much real estate. Make one of those communicating stairs an egress stair. And it's probably one of the most beautiful features of the building. I highly encourage you to go check it out. And I mentioned the reflectivity. So the reflectivity of concrete is when you use slag and fly ash, the byproduct of cement, it actually turns the concrete very white. And so when we talk about integrated designs and integrated approach to building the PUC building, people refer to it as HVAC. Those are the things that you attack to get to your green points. Well, Ed mentioned earlier, we have a high-performance building skin. That building skin has a very high-performance glass. The shape of the actual building skin harnesses the wind and accelerates it towards the vertical wind turbines. And it's a high-performance, strong building skin. So when we talk about an integrated project, this is probably one of the most integrated buildings I've ever seen. Ed mentioned that it's one of the smartest buildings. We have what we call integrated building systems. So where you have various different silos of controls, it's integrated to one higher-level platform. It won RealCom in Vegas, one of the smartest buildings, and very proud of it. I don't think Ed's heard yet, but it won another award last week at the Apex Awards in Vegas. That's for the digital arts wall that Ed referred to earlier. It is a highly communicative tool for arts, for educational, for information. It tracks how much energy is being used by each floor, and it's a very engaging, interactive tool in the lobby. So this is the carbon. This image I wanted to share with you because it's measured by Climate Earth, and it tracks all of the tons of CO2, the embodied energy, in six categories of the building. One is the building envelope. One is the structure. One is mechanical, electrical, and plumbing. The interior finishes, and what we refer to as it's a small number as other materials, and site work and overhead. And so all of these totaled, the structure alone contributed to 54% reduction. That is 7.4 million pounds of carbon footprint. And what we didn't really mention in here is a lot of the interior finishes as required to meet LEED requirements is a lot of these materials are highly renewable, locally sourced. If you notice, there's the granite on the building is the same granite as the Civic Center buildings. It's called Sierra White Granite. That is a California locally sourced stone that's beautiful, and it has an understated elegance in the way it was placed and sited in the Civic Center area. These are the what I call the specs for the cement replacement that I mentioned earlier. It's actually one of my favorite slides I like to share. So the embodied energy of carbon footprint, carbon dioxide in different materials, in wood, in mixed steel and wood, in steel because it has a lot of scrap metal that's recycled, is fairly low. And you look at concrete, it's very tall. It's in this image, and it's a lot. But the blue line you see there is the contribution of CO2 from cement. That takes up about 70% of the entire concrete mix. That's the water, the aggregate, the cement, any accelerators they may have. So when you reduce that contribution from cement of CO2 by 70%, you now have a building that's more green than steel mix and a wood frame building. It's a powerful statement. So to give you an example, the MAP Foundation for 8,000 PSI strength, high strength to be met by 90 days, the maximum cement that we allowed was 200 pounds per cubic yard. The columns and shear walls, 225. So to give you an idea, 200 pounds, the amount of cement in a cubic yard is about 600 pounds. We only allowed 200 in this case. And the rest had to be used by a byproduct that would have gone to waste and landfills instead of we use it for good things. This is important to know because there's a debate in the national discourse about the slag and fly ash because of some earthen dams that have broken on the East Coast, there's thought by the EPA to just ban it altogether. For us in the building industry, we're saying, no, it's actually a good thing. We can reuse it for a good cause rather than bad cause. So lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about the living machine. This is advanced wetland technology in a very compact site at the building that treats gray and black water. So it essentially has about five what we call planters. So what happens is the sewage that comes out of the building goes into what we call a trash tank and a settling tank. So what, as it moves through each cell, it gets treated by actions of a tidal movement. So the rise and fall of a tidal water treats it. So when it rises, it feeds it the nutrients to the shales. As it lowers, it sucks oxygen down. So we have plants that eat up those pathogens and you can reuse it in the building. So we can treat about 5,000 gallons a day. The building produces about 4,000 gallons of wastewater. This is another image. You see the bottom, the red tank, that's a trash tank and the settling tank. And then it moves on to what we call an equalization tank and a recirculation tank. And from there, we can send it to two stages of treatment or to one at a time. And then from there, it goes from a regular tidal flow to a vertical fed system to feed it the pathogens. And actually, the last treatment cell is both indoor and outdoor. So you can be in the lower lobby of the building and see plants. It looks like a regular planter, but it's actually a treatment facility that treats wastewater. And from there on, it goes to the top of the building and is reused for toilets and different things. This is another image of the same thing. Just talks about it's compact. It's in an urban area. The oxygen fills the cells as it drains and converts to ammonia and nitrate. And the carbohydrates to CO2, and the water refills the cell, and the nitrate becomes N2 gas, and the remaining carbohydrates are removed, and the same process is over and over again. It can be reused, as I mentioned, for irrigation, for toilet flushing, and so on and so forth. Thank you. With that, I'll let Ed back up.
Thank you, Brooke, and that's why I brought him with me to go through that. Again, I have a much more user perspective, and I think what happens is you'll see that there's the Broward building over in the East Bay, or you see the new federal building, and people get there and they say, but it's not a very friendly building, or it's a cold building, or it's a sick building, or things. We wanted to really make sure that this was a building that was welcoming the people who worked there and the people who came in to pay their bills and people who came in to visit and do things. And so we really spent a lot of time trying to make sure the building worked for the people that were involved. This is another shot of that wall. In San Francisco, whenever you do any kind of work in a building that's a city-owned building, you have to put 2% aside for art. And so there's two major art things that were done by the Arts Commission, and that is the front of the building, and you'll see a slide of that. We've been in different places, so I'll bring it back up. And that's what we call the Firefly Wall. It was what we're showing before we started this evening. That's by a guy named Ned Kahn, who is a local artist in Sonoma County. And it's about 20 feet wide and 10 stories tall. And it moves with the wind in the daytime, and you can see the waves of it. And then at nighttime, it has a LED light that moves as it goes back, as the wind hits it. And so from that part of San Francisco, you see this whole Firefly Wall. He tried to match the LED light to the light of a firefly. For those of you from San Francisco, you wouldn't know what that is. But for a lot of people, they know what that means. And so you'll see this glittering wall on the side. And then when you walk into the building, there's also a water wall between the two lobbies. So they had spent all of the money from that building before I got there, and I thought, but the building has to have art. It has to have a welcoming thing. And luckily, the PUC is doing all this other construction work in places that no one will ever see it. And so we just finished building a wastewater treatment plant out in Tesla. Tesla is about 2 miles off of Highway 5 in nowhere. But that was spinning off $800,000 for art. And so we convinced the Art Commission to let us use that money in this building. This wall here is about 60 feet long and about 3.5-4 feet tall. And it is it tells different stories. We use it for student groups. We use it for all kinds of things because one of the pictures, this one here, is what we call snowfall to outfall. It shows everything from Hetchy all the way down to the outfall from the sewer system. And as you walk up the handicap ramp that's in front of it, it comes out and talks to you. So if you stand in front of a treatment facility, it'll open up and tell you what that treatment facility is and what it does. So it's educational for anybody kind of walking through. You also see on this slide, it has, this is one of the other apps, it's a story of the building. And it really is just apps. If you have the right iPad and your right software, I can sit there and bring up different kinds of things on that screen. One of the screens is the stats. Brooke mentioned this. It shows how much power is being used by every floor of the building. It shows how much, it shows the next BART train leaving. It shows what's the amount of water in storage up at Hetchy. It shows how much wastewater we're processing at the wastewater treatment plant. It shows all kinds of stats about the Public Utilities Commission, again, to get people knowledgeable about what we do for a living. And there's a cafe there. So when you walk into the first floor of the building, it's a welcoming place for workers and visitors. There's food, and there's also some education. And this is the living machine, as Brooke said. It's both inside and outside. Right there next to the cafe is a sewage treatment plant. Pretty cool. It looks nice. We're still trying to find the right plants to live, but it looks pretty nice. Children facility, child care center is right there off the first floor, too. The elevators, when you go up to get into the building, it's destination elevators. Some of you will have seen these often in hotels at this point. But before you get into the elevator, you decide what floor you're going to. You push it in. It tells you which elevator to go to. It groups people together. It therefore uses much less energy, and it also gets you to your destination much faster. There's no buttons inside the elevator, so if you don't decide before you get in, you just go wherever else anybody else is going, and you try again. So their destination, and again, it is much faster movement and much more efficient to move people through. You'll notice most of the floors are open plans like this. We spent a lot of time working with our staff to make sure they would be happy working in there. The average workspace is about an 8x8 cubicle. A lot of people like tall cubicles for privacy, but that would have wrecked any kind of daylighting coming in and being used by everybody. So we convinced them, and you'll see this in a couple other slides, that there was going to be a whole lot more we space and a whole lot less me space for you in this building. And after some educational processes, that didn't sound as bad to people. But so we gave them some glass partitions, so you got some privacy, but you didn't cut the light from everybody else in the building. And so that's why you see the glass in between, but they really do provide a whole lot of light coming in. We made sure that we had different configurations and had the staff come in and vote. What do you think of this kind of space? Do you want a straight desk or a curved desk? You'll notice on one of the slides, there's their file cabinet is underneath the desk. The other slide, it pulls out, and that's your guest chair. So your file cabinet is your guest chair, and that's what the green pad is on top for you to be visiting with people. Every other floor has a major shared lounge that people can use for lunches and for a variety of things. But every floor also has a canteen. So if you don't have a major lounge, there's a place you can get water, coffee, that kind of thing. We wanted to change behavior when we went into the building, and so we made sure we did not give people file space, and we didn't let them have individual printers. And so there's centralized file space, and then you have what's at your desk, and that's pretty much it. And you also have central printers, but no printers in any individual offices, no printers in any desks. And people took a little bit of getting used to for that. But again, you don't need to print. You don't need to use as much paper. And it was the great time with education to change behaviors and, again, make this not just a livable building, but make the way that we treated that building much more sustainable also. A lot of conference rooms. You'll notice on one of those conference rooms, the windows are slanted there. You'll notice if you go by the building that the upper corner on the north side is slanted, and that was to avoid shading a schoolyard that's about two blocks away. And it made for a very nice kind of strange-looking conference room to have this slanted wall up there. But every conference room has a lot of technology in it. Most of the conference rooms have video conferencing ability because we have facilities in the Central Valley. We have facilities at Hetchy. We have facilities in the South Bay and East Bay. So we really do a lot as opposed to driving and having a higher carbon footprint. The stairs, again, really a big deal to get people to move from floor to floor. In our old building, all the floors were locked for security purposes, and you only went to the floor if you needed to go to that floor, and there was very little communication in the building. This was intended to make sure people could move around the building. This is the big art that I mentioned. That's the firefly wall in the very front of the building that's there, and that also is the wall that scoops the air in back of it for those wind turbines. The stairs going up on both sides of that is the water wall, and that is plastic, basically, but it has water going through it that you can hear the water moving and you can see the water moving. Again, a water statement and a power statement for a building that does water and power, the living machine being the wastewater statement in the building. We also said, you know, we have a lot of art And there's a lot of people that are artists in San Francisco. And if we wanted to get 40% of the workers building the building to be local San Franciscans, why not have artists that are in San Francisco? So I took some money from another building we had just finished and brought that into this also. And this building has work by 100 local artists in San Francisco or art galleries in the building. It makes it a much warmer building. We also have full-time photographers for the PUC for forensic purposes as we're doing all this building, and we used a lot of their art. So we have historic art of the PUC, that would be the founder on the bottom there, O'Shaughnessy, but other art in the building. We have San Francisco art. Most of these are prints, but some original art that's in the building, that so everybody has a warm place to work. We have construction photos that are throughout the building that are great photos that have won all kinds of awards in magazines. I'm sure you subscribe to, like, the Engineering News and Pipeline News or whatever that one is. But, yes, they do that. And then the power generation, again, 7% of the power comes from solar and also from the wind turbines in front of the building. It's a great building for views. When anybody comes into the building, especially law enforcement people, they say, great, whenever we have something happening in Civic Center, we're going to come up here to watch it, because you really get a nice view of Civic Center, a nice view of City Hall. And from again, when the whole building is glass and you don't have a lot of offices there, everybody gets a view, everybody gets light. We do tours pretty much every Friday for those of you who hadn't had a chance to see it yet. And you can go on to sfwater.org and arrange for a tour. It really is worth going and seeing. It really is it's a fun building. And with that, I think we have about 15 minutes for questions. I'll bring Ann back up.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California and Ed and Brooke discussing the new San Francisco Public, a PUC LEED Platinum headquarters building. Actually, before we start questioning, one thing he didn't mention, which I really loved, was the child care center, which is in the first floor. And it's really wonderfully done and has at least 65 kids. Yeah. So that was also a part of the building that was really, I thought, unique. So now we're going to open up for questions, and if you just wave at me, I'll give you the mic. Remember to speak into the mic, and we can ask Ed and Brooke questions if you have them. Oh, that's right, I can't take that. We're on the mic now.
Thank you. As a green building building professional, this is a really wonderful building to see, and it makes me feel proud to be a resident of San Francisco. So thank you for that. I'm losing my voice. What would you say would be the most challenging LEED credits you sought?
Brooke?
I would say energy and atmospheric, and the other one being regional materials. Given that we are on the coast, a lot of times for regional materials you need to get or source the material within 500 miles, while the other 250 is in the ocean, right? Okay. So we were challenged quite a bit, but we did meet the 10% regional materials. 20%, to this date, I haven't seen any project meet that. That tends to be much tougher to do.
And you're in charge of the new building for the Commonwealth Club, right? So do us proud.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the economics of LEED Platinum certification. For example, what would be the payback period from energy savings for the additional construction costs?
That very good question, by the way. But so some of the return on the investment is a little skewed because the PUC is a power company. It provides us the power, so they pay a lot less for power and water. So that tends to skew it. From the standpoint of return in general, the return on the investment, as Ed mentioned, it's about 26 years. Given the shift of, instead of paying lease or rent, to a different owner. You pay it off in 25 years, but you build a 100-year building so that you have those savings over the next 75 years. That's in addition to energy cost savings of $118 million that Ed mentioned earlier. Hope I have to answer your question.
Why 100 years? Why not maybe 200 years? There's plenty of buildings in San Francisco that are older than 100 years.
And I think we would love to have it last that long for a variety of reasons. You don't typically talk about a building lasting longer than that, but that doesn't mean it was designed to fall down in 100 years. It's just that we didn't want to look, you know, we could have looked like we were exaggerating at some point the payback if we said over 200 years it's going to save even more money, and so we picked 100 years, but the building should last. I mean, again, as Brooke said, this is your water, power, wastewater system. In an earthquake or anything else, we want to be back in there immediately because our operations center is in that building. And so we expect it to be survivable. We expect it to sustain that the concrete with the bridge building thing should let the building twist and turn in an earthquake. And it's the epitome of sustainability is it returns itself to its original shape and you can go back in the building. So all of that should make it last a long time. But, you know, right now, I think for the O'Shaughnessy Dam, we listed it as 75-year life. Well, we've now reached that. But you had to put something in for depreciation purposes, for accounting, and something to just make the system work. It doesn't say it's going to end at that period.
That's a good point, Ed. The other thing is, you know, there's a certain amount of deferred maintenance and upkeep that you do. But you do reach a point where you start doing major renovations. So maybe you're taking down both what we call air handling units, the big HVAC equipment. And when you start to reach that point, then it's not just now about the investment anymore. It's about reinvestment. But just because we say it's 100 years, as Ed said, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to crumble in 100 years. It'll probably last quite a long time after that.
I was actually at your building today, and I was hoping to get a tour, but of course you don't do them except on Fridays.
We did them a lot when we first opened, but we had to kind of calm down after a while.
Yeah, but I was actually interested in art more than PUC, sorry. So I love that, the firefly thing that you have outside, and then I noticed that you had the rainwater that you were talking about. But you mentioned that you've got four other galleries. Are they actually open to the public, or do we have to go on a tour to see those?
You have to go on a tour to see all of the works inside the building. I said we had 100 local artists or galleries that were represented in the building in some fashion. So about a third of the art, a third to a half of the art is by our own artists and our own photographers, and about half is from local artists, but they're throughout the building. We did have an art opening and invited all the artists to come and do that, which was kind of a nice thing. But, it isn't open all the time.
Hi. I was thinking of, when you were talking about LEED, that the L in LEED stands for leadership, and certainly the PUC is exerting a lot of leadership, not just in your building, but in your operations and other things that you're doing in the city and the region. Could you have any fun and interesting anecdotes of others who have come to you for lessons learned, looked for building advice, want to kind of see how to do things, or you know, learn from maybe mistakes that you made along the way so that they can replicate those designs and extend your impact beyond just your own building?
Very good question. Ed alluded to, we did a lot of tours when we finished last summer. We did a lot of tours. But in addition to that, I think I've accommodated folks from around the world, from New Zealand, from Denmark, from Indonesia, who are very interested in it. But also local schools, Academy of Art, giving a tour sometime in April for them, a lot of technical tours. People have taken this project on as case studies, students around the Bay Area, in the state and around the country. So there's a lot of interest in how this was done, how it can be replicated, and how it can set an example for not only other municipalities, but also in the private sector. You know, we have in San Francisco, when you do a new building, developers, private sector, they have to do a LEED Gold, just as the public sector has to do LEED Gold. So it's really caught the attention of both the public and the private sector, and there's a lot of lessons learned that we've been able to share, happily so.
Also, a few weeks ago, Lisa Jackson, the head of the EPA, was out doing a tour of the building. The old head of the EPA is as of today, but yes.
Thank you for your presentation. It's very nice. My question has to do with a lot of times when you're working with smart buildings, the weakest link in it it's after the building is opened and the maintenance department or the users or somebody, they can't deal with the smart building. Everything's, you know, takes such expertise in maintaining that the whole system kind of falls apart, or the potential for it to fall apart is there. So what advice do you have on that? And that's the biggest thing that I see with building users, is that they're going, yeah, this is great and the payback's good, but my maintenance department, you know, they're getting paid $10 an hour and, you know, it's got to be simple. So
part
of advice on that?
Yeah, part of it is that we do pay our city employees more than that, typically. But we knew that the standard... You've read that in the paper somewhere. The standard custodial type building engineers would not be able to do this. It would really be asking too much for them. But we also have a commitment to have our own employees try to do this work. And so what we did was we went out and got a contract with an outside group that knows how to run smart buildings. So they're managing the building for us. We also have brought in engineers that work for the city, and they're learning from them. So we have two engineers from our wastewater treatment plant who are full-time in the building, learning from the outside people. So the hope is that we will be able to grow our own, and they will learn it, and they'll be able to take over the building. But we didn't want to start the building off not knowing what we're doing when we were trying all those different things. So we went and did hire an outside consulting firm that can bring in their own experts as things go wrong or as things work right, and then train us. We wanted to make sure it wasn't just a LEED Platinum building and then you wreck it. And that was why, you know, all the people, little portable, you know, heating devices, we ripped them out of their hands walking in the building. The printers, I mean, all the things you do to really make a building not sustainable, we really made a big educational push to change behavior for that. And then we brought in outside people to help us do it right.
I'm interested to know how quickly the whole movement, the whole green movement is happening. And like the standards, the gold, the platinum, and so forth, how old are they? And then 10 years from now, what would be available that's not available now?
I am a LEED accredited professional. I don't know how long LEED has been around. I think it's about 10 to 15 years or so. But that tends to be a more U.S.-based measuring stick for the green ability of a building, per se. There's different measuring systems around the world. But there's also a lot of things we did on this project that LEED doesn't recognize. You know, I wish we had ways to, you know, pick off three or four additional points based on whether it's the innovations of the integration of the control systems or you know, the use of high cementitious material replacement that we did for cement. You know, if we were able to utilize some of those into LEED, it would be great. I think LEED is getting better. LEED Forward, I think it comes out this summer in July, and they're adding a bunch of different things like certified materials and things like that. But it is a good measuring stick, a common measuring stick that can be used by both engineers, architects, and contractors. And it's the bus has left the station. You've got to jump on.
The notion of building your own building has been around for a long time, 15 or 20 years, maybe perhaps longer than that, that I could probably track. You also got it built in a recession. And I'm curious on two things. Where the financing eventually pushed through, because you kept raising it, I mean, your predecessors, and it went to the bottom of the pile. It got left out of a budget, you know, time after time and so on. And you finally got it through. It's a wonderful building, certainly. So the other part of it is, what were the telling arguments to persuade the board and the mayor that, you know, you're wasting time, you're losing money? I mean, sort of the obvious things, but also to take a risk to appropriate that much money. So the combination of those things.
So, yeah, the old state building was damaged in the 1989 earthquake. and it just stayed there for a very long time, and the city kept trying to figure out what to do with that space. We thought at one time it should be the building for all the HR functions of the city, but all those things were general fund, and it was too expensive for general fund. And so that's why, after years of wandering through that, Public Works started going out and hiring the architects and doing everything else, but they had no clients still. When we looked at the PUC and said, you know, we can probably afford to spend a little more as a building that's a showcase for us, as long as it's still appropriately funded. When I got there in 2008, it was $40 million over budget. We were at the beginning of our water system improvement program, and I said, I can't build a building that's a bureaucratic Taj Mahal when we're not doing the water system rebuild that we're supposed to do. So I put it on hold for a year and a half, which made Gavin Newsom a little crazy. But I did it until we went through all the environmental reviews and started our water system improvement and really got that going. So we could prove to people we can build a water system and we can build a building. We have the capacity to do all of those things at once. The water system was $4.5 billion. So when you're starting to borrow $4.5 billion, you're one of the largest borrowers in California. So if you're borrowing a couple hundred million dollars for a building, it just rolled in with the rest of it, frankly. Because we were borrowing $1 billion a year for the water system. And so it really was able to just fit into that, and it was a great time. We were getting money at 3.5% in some cases. So it was a wonderful time to be doing it. But by delaying it and stopping it that last time, we also went to concrete and did other things to reduce that back into the amount of money that we thought was worthwhile. We thought it was okay to spend a bit more to make a showcase, but not so much that it would be something that would embarrass us with our ratepayers. And so we brought the money. We kept knocking things off, but keeping the core of the building to what we thought was important.
If I could just add to that, that's really the most important decision that Ed made at the time. By stopping it for that short amount of time, you know, you can cut and value engineer as much as you can. At some point, you reach a point where you start actually cutting some of the project's objectives, some of the green portions. But we didn't want to do that. We wanted to meet the objectives and the goals that were set by Ed, but the economy also tanked at the 2008. So that's the last bit of what I call natural VE, natural value engineering, that got us over the hump. So it was a lot of smart decisions and a little bit of luck.
We've come to that point in our program when there's one last question, and as chair of the program, I get to ask that question. I want to know for each of you briefly, what is your best, what are you proudest of in the building? And the second question is, there's two, what was most frustrating? You can fudge if you wish.
That's a tough one. I'd have to say the best feature I'd have to say is the Firefly art piece. I think it's one of the most stunning features of the building by the artist Ned Kahn. It did receive the best public art of 2012 by John King, The Chronicle. I would say the most frustrating would be the complexity of the project. It was very complex, and it took a team. It took actually a client that allowed the team to be as collaborative and innovative as possible and took a chance on the project team to try and deliver that. And so that's the most frustration, because when you think you're done, you're really not done because of the complexities that somebody brought up about the technologies, is you're constantly tweaking over time goes, because it's what we refer to as a living building. It gets bright, the shades come down, and clouds come over, San Francisco, the shades go up. And so you have users that are in that space. And so you want to fine-tune it as quick as possible to minimize the frustration of the users. So that's my...
And I'll reverse it. On the frustration part, it was that we came in as the client after a lot of it had been designed already. And you'd walk in the building and think, well, that is fabulous, and that is stupid. Who would have thought of that? It's like, well, that's in there. Shut up. Just move on, right? And so there were a number of those times when I'd say, well, why would someone do that? And that, you know... In some cases, I just said, no, you have to change it. You can't have the major conference room have walls with no light into the conference room. And why is the one window it has goes out to a big power vent or a big venting thing? So there's stuff in the building you think, what were they thinking? The fun part, though, is that we wanted it to be where people were proud to come and work and proud to come and visit and proud to say that it was their PUC as workers or as ratepayers and others, and that's worked. The people who work there love working in the building. The people who come there say, wow, this is a very cool building, and this stands for what San Francisco stands for and what we believe in. And so that worked. It was great.
Our thanks to Ed and Brooke tonight for all their work and for telling us about 525 Golden Gate Avenue, a vision of architecture, city planning, and LEED Platinum work. I'm Ann Clark, and in a minute I'm going to call this meeting to a close. But since we've been talking about buildings, I wanted to also remind you that on May 10th, we will be talking with the architect and the artist who have been involved in the new Exploratorium, which you know is going to be opening in April. A slightly different building, a building that's really perceived as dedicated to education and experiencing the world in a way through education of the building and what's in the building. So I hope you will join us on May 10th. I think it's going to be a really exciting for those of us who love the Exploratorium, which is just about everybody in San Francisco. I think it would be an exciting evening. So now, as we have come to that time when we must say goodbye to each other, I'm Ann Clark, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.